What's up, guys? Today, we got another exciting interview. Today, we have Ambassador Michael Oren. Michael Oren is former Israeli ambassador to the United States. He served from 2009 to 2013. Additionally, he's a politician, historian, novelist. He was named one of the world's most influential Jews by media outlets. Ambassador Oren, am I missing anything?
I got three kids and six grandkids. How about that? So those are the true accomplishments in life.
I agree. That's what makes life worth it. So accomplished father and grandfather. And there's really probably no one as well-versed in Israel as him. So, Michael, I wanted to focus more on October 7th and the events after, but your story sort of resonated with me as an American Jew, and just given Jewish history and our connection to the land, it's something that's very meaningful. So I was curious, you were born and raised in America. What sort of sparked your interest and love for Israel? What made you drawn to the country and wanting to work in diplomacy?
Well, I think you may know that I'm somewhat older than you, Jeremy. Right. So I grew up in a period in American Jewish history where Jews were still a distinct ethnic group.
Right.
We ate different food. We ate bagels. No one else ate bagels. The bagels were small and hard. and Jewish humor was Jewish humor. It wasn't American humor. We were a very, very distinct ethnic group. And if you actually were given a form, they asked you to put your race, you would put Jewish.
Wow.
It would not have occurred to any of us to say we were white. That was the last thing that occurred to us. We didn't consider ourselves white. We considered ourselves Jewish. And very different. And I grew up in a working class neighborhood where we were the only Jewish family. And Sicilian neighborhood. And I got myself beat up pretty much every day for being a Christ killer and learning to, you know, defend myself the best I could with my fist. Sometimes it didn't work. And I got pretty beat up. I'd come home and my father, who was a World War II hero, had landed on Normandy Beach, fought all the way through World War II together with his brother. It's a great story. And they liberated a concentration camp. And they took pictures of the concentration camp. And they kept them in an album. I now have that album. I actually carry it in my cell phone. And the pictures are indelibly horrible. And my father would open up this album and say, hey, show me the pictures and say, you see that, son? That's why we need a strong state of Israel. And when you see that, and you're sitting there with a bloody nose because you've just been called, you know, called a Christ killer, that has a very powerful impact on you. I lived through, as a child, through the period of Six-Day War. And we all remember the great victory of the Six-Day War and the paratroopers dancing around the Kotel. That's not what I remember. I remember the 3 weeks before the Six-Day War when Israel was surrounded by Arab armies. They were going to throw us in the sea and nobody was going to do anything. America was going to do anything. We're going to have a second Holocaust in a single generation. So that really convinced me that Jews can only rely on Jews. It's something that's a message that's being reinforced as we speak today. And lest we have forgotten. When I was 15, I started to go off to kibbutz. I started going off and working as a farmer. I wasn't a very good farmer. I was a bigger farmer. I was a cowboy up on the Golan Heights. I learned to ride. And I joined the Zionist youth movement back in the States. And we went to a trip to Washington, D.C. And I had the great honor of meeting Israel's ambassador to the United States and shook his hand. And I said to myself at 15, that's what I want to be when I grow up. I want to be Israel's ambassador to the United States. The gentleman's name was Yitzhak Rabin. And later, I became an advisor to Yitzhak Rabin, so it was quite a story for me. But that was my goal in life. My goal in life was to be Israel's ambassador. I was able to fulfill that. But first, I had actually moved to Israel. I was a lone soldier in the paratroopers. Altogether, served about 35 years in the military. My kids served in the military in wars. You know, the Israeli story, terror and all, and several milestones in that. One would be working underground with Soviet Jews. During the Soviet period, which is very rough, and being interrogated every day at length by the KGB, that'll make you a Zionist, and various public roles, from being an advisor to Israel's ambassador to the United Nations, serving on government committees, and finally being in Knesset. I was a Knesset member for about 4 years, and the deputy to the prime minister. So all these were milestones in becoming, I guess, me. And in between, I went back and did PhD in Middle Eastern history and became a writer of Middle Eastern history.
Absolutely. And this reinforces that there's no one really more knowledgeable on this subject than you. And like you mentioned, you did grow up in a different time. You really saw the need for Israel. Like, I grew up at a different time in the United States. I grew up in a Jewish neighborhood. You know, I never really felt different, so to speak. I think the one thing that really resonated with me, my journey, was going to Poland and seeing the death camps. That really reinforced the need for a Jewish state. You lived through it all and definitely understand why you love for Israel. I think it's amazing that you sort of spoke what you wanted to do in existence. I think that's really cool as well. So going towards present day, I did want to talk about October 7th. I just want to hear your thoughts on the morning of, and it's completely different because you're in Israel. At the time, just to give you a personal anecdote, I was in Washington, D.C. I got a notification on my phone about Hamas infiltrating. I saw videos and pictures of like people in the streets of Sderot, the guys on those parachutes coming in at the Nova Music Festival. And my heart sank, and I just kept updating the news the entire day. So I'm curious about your initial thoughts about what happened that day, what you were thinking. And I know you recently visited a kibbutz near the Gaza border. You spoke with soldiers. You spoke with people there. You saw it. So give me your thoughts on that as well.
Well, strangely enough, on October 5th, I was in Dallas, Texas. I wasn't in Israel. I was giving a talk to a group of real estate leaders. And I was talking about the U.S.-Israel relationship. But at the end, I said, listen, I don't want to shock anybody, but I think Israel's soon going to be at war. I'm not a prophet, but I sometimes have a good sense of connecting dots. And here are the dots I connected. The United States was trying to broker a peace agreement between Saudi Arabia and Israel, which had a nuclear component. It was going to give Saudi Arabia nuclear power. And Iranians were going to be damned that they were just going to sit there and watch while Israel and the Saudi Arabia formed a joint strategic economic front against them, and while the Iranians are going to be damned that they're going to sit there and let Saudi Arabia get nuclear power. And they looked at Israel, and Israel was totally divided over the judicial review issue. The United States was paralyzed politically. You couldn't even elect the Speaker of the House. And without getting too political, the Iranians were afraid of the return of Donald Trump. Because with Biden, they had certainty. They knew what the president's policy would be. Nobody knew what the Trump's policy could be. And remember, Trump had pulled out of the Iranian nuclear program in agreement in 2018. Very unpredictable. So from an Iranian perspective, I thought it was the perfect time to start a little war. You start a little war, it all goes away. The peace goes away. Everything goes away. And I was only wrong for one reason. That was because I thought it would break out in the north with Hezbollah. And I thought, in many ways, I subscribed to the official Israeli position, and I was in government when this position was, you know, was adopted through successive governments. It wasn't just Netanyahu; it was also Bennett, and that was that the Hamas could be paid off if you gave them enough Qatari cash, and you let enough Palestinian workers into Israel every day. Hamas wouldn't go to war; they would have too much to lose.
Right.
That was what they call the concepcia. But I was right about the war, and so on October 7th, I was actually visiting my late mother. In New Jersey, woke up, you look on your cell phone, you get what every Israeli never wants to see on the phone, cell phone. That's several dozen messages saying, are you okay? Are you okay? Which means one thing. There's a reason why you might not be okay.
Right.
And immediately heard about this. Now, I have a long-standing relationship with some very generous benefactors here that whenever there's a crisis, they hire PR firms to get me on TV.
Right.
So if you saw me on that, even that morning on MSNBC, CNN,
I did.
That was yes, immediately. Amanpour was the first thing I did. You don't want to do that. I'm in an MSNBC and Amanpour on the, you can't make this up. but I also needed to get back. So I pulled a lot of strings, and I'll say this unabashedly, to get me on the first flight out. And I got on the first flight out. That flight was extraordinary in itself because it was filled with reservists coming home.
Right. Yeah.
LL was incredible. They deserve a tremendous amount of credit for freeing up seats, reservists coming home. There were just long lines of these people. And what a scene that was. And little did I know that that was going to be the beginning of a procession that was going to lead to, at the very minimum, 100% response to call up to 150% response to call up in the reserves. The call up of 360,000 reservists, which would be per capita the equivalent of about 20 million Americans.
Wow.
That's quite amazing. That's actually more Americans than served in all World War II.
That's incredible. I think the one thing that's really interesting is just Israel has all of its political problems. You're having protests right before October 7th. They could get unified like no other when there's a threat, which is incredible.
Well, that's the good news. The bad news is the state didn't function. Okay, the army didn't show up. And to this day, we don't know why the army didn't show up. It was delays of between 7 and 12 hours. You know, I live in Jaffa. I'm a 40-45 minute drive from Gaza. Why the army took 12 hours to get there, nobody knows just yet. It has to be investigated.
Right.
And the state organs, its agencies didn't function either. There was no one visiting the hostage families, no one visiting the displaced people. We're talking about 200,000 displaced people. to say nothing of all the families, the bereaved families of people who were killed on October 7th. No one was visiting them. So that was the horrible news. And that's the news that that's the huge challenge we face. And the future is rebuilding the covenant between the state of Israel and the people of Israel, which was that covenant was broken October 7th. It's more complicated than that because the question is how you can rebuild the covenant and redeem the hostages because they're not compatible objectives. The easiest thing for Israel to do would be to go into Gaza, fill up all the tunnels with gasoline and throw in a match. Can't do that.
Yeah, there might be hostages.
So we end up trying to do both. We try to destroy Hamas and relieve the hostages. I actually know of no country in history that ever had to face a dilemma like that, ever. Terrific.
It is.
The last point I'll make is that here's the good news. The good news is that Israeli society revealed itself to be by far the strongest society on earth, the most resilient society, and the only society in history that I know that didn't wait for a state to act. It actually picked up and acted on its own spontaneously and very effectively. And so October 8th, no sooner I'd landed back in Israel than I was already in touch with an NGO established actually in my building in Jaffa to visit the families of the hostages. I was doing that already on October 8th, October 9th, and other tremendous initiatives to bring food to soldiers, food, clothing, the articles, military articles, equipment they were missing, to extend housing and amenities and food to the displaced people. All this was done without state direction. I don't know anything like it in history, Darren.
It's absolutely unprecedented. My other question was, you were able to go near the kibbutz, near the Gaza border, and you saw the destruction there. Like, what were your thoughts?
Well, I've been there several times. I was 3 days ago, I was there with doing a film with Barry Weiss.
Right.
Who's remarkable. You'd think that after doing it several times, being out in Kfar Aza, being down in Nahal Oz, that you would be able to internalize it better, to sort of wrap your head around it better. But each time it actually gets more difficult. Having spent years on kibbutz, having lived in a community like this where, you know, young couples would gather on a lawn on a Friday night and sit around and schmooze all night and play guitar and pass a bottle. And at 6 o'clock in the morning, that morning, they were all dead. And not just dead, but horrific. That you can't, it's very difficult to wrap your head around. Just is. And we don't have a better word for wrapping it. Sorry, I don't have a more sophisticated word, but it's literally wrapping your head around. And this time we went to the scene of the Nova massacre, and we went with several survivors who told their stories. And everyone who survived that survived not because of a miracle; they survived because of a series of miracles. And it's one after another. And that is difficult, very difficult to internalize, to imagine. And what you're thinking all the time is, what would I have done? How could I have survived? There's a certain mechanism in your brain, which is quite odd, quite, you know, apparently it's hardwired into us. How would we survive? And I think it's a question, certainly Jews of my generation, I can't speak for yours, we grew up thinking, okay, how would we have survived the Holocaust? What was our escape mechanism? I grew up with Nazi dreams. You know, the SS coming knocking on our door. And if I talk to Jews of my generation, many of us had the same dreams. This generation dreams of Hamas at the door.
And it's sad, you know, after the Holocaust, nothing's really changed. So this needs to be investigated, obviously, but, you know, Israel's a country that prides itself on its intelligence. You know, Shin Bet is one of the most internal security agencies in the world. I understand IDF soldiers were complaining about some unusual behavior on the border. How is this able to happen? How did intelligence services fail so catastrophically?
Well, the intelligence failure, again, has to be investigated. And it's a huge intelligence failure. I think having been in government in the military for many years is a tremendous tendency to overestimate the military intelligence. It's kind of an oxymoron. And I'll give you an example. In 2011, IDF intelligence informed me that Bashar al-Assad would not be in government longer than 2 months. And here we are.
Still here, you know.
When Trump recognized Israel, Jerusalem as our capital, the intelligence estimate was that half the Middle East would go up in flames and that that would make Jerusalem the center of all controversies from then on. All right? Didn't happen. No flames, no center of controversies. Hardly anybody talks about it anymore. Right? They're wrong. So military intelligence deals with probabilities. It's not an absolute. Having said all that, October 7th was a colossal intelligence failure. And from what we know, there were elements in the intelligence core that were warning of this, including messages made by the young women soldiers who reconnoitered our border. By the way, only women can do this. They only we men do not have the attention span to do what they do.
Is it actually the reason?
Yeah, exactly the reason. Only women, no men. So interesting. There were several jobs in the army like this that only women can do because of their, you know, I don't care what they say in the United States, American campuses, there are different emotional differences. There are some
I agree. That's a whole other conversation.
I might just parenthetically, my daughter was in the Golani Brigade as a medical social worker dealing with wounded soldiers. No men can do this, only women. Men can't take the emotional strain. Men can't take the emotional strain. So men don't have the attention span. We have these women who will look at a swath of border that may be 15 meters wide, and they will go back and forth and see if a blade of grass is missing or a stone has been moved. Okay. And they'll report this. These reports weren't taken seriously. And I think a lot of it, what we think now is a lot of it had to do with, you know, they were dismissed because these files were these reports were filed by women and not by men. We don't know. We also know of a very broad intelligence estimate that Hamas was planning this. They knew the name of the operation. They knew the details of the operation. But because we had this preconception that Hamas didn't want war or either that, and it was incompetent, couldn't actually mount a war, these reports were dismissed as aspirational, something that Hamas wanted to do but actually couldn't do, you know, or wouldn't dare do. And again, all of this is going to be investigated. This is the day after. We have a massive amount of rebuilding to do. Physical rebuilding, of course, but it's institutional rebuilding and it's psychological rebuilding. And to say nothing of like the physical rebuilding of the many thousands of soldiers who have been wounded, which almost nobody is talking about. We're talking about very grievous wounds. And I've heard now of hundreds of soldiers who have been blinded, crippled. The level of soldiers coming out, we have a survival rate, which is very, very high now because of the advances in medicine, but it's we haven't begun to deal with the level of handicapped people in our society now.
Yeah, it's horrible. I mean, it's a horrible situation. I know urban combat is probably the toughest combat you could possibly undertake.
It is indeed.
Just in terms of Israel's gains in the ground invasion, how are the objectives going? I know, obviously, the goal is to completely eliminate Hamas. Israeli forces captured North Gaza with relative ease. And in terms of hostages, what's the situation on that front? Like, I know there's some exchanges. Are we going to be looking forward to
more? We don't know. I think Israel would be open to, you know, ceasefires, temporary ceasefires in exchange for hostages. We've proven that we are willing to do that. Of course, is Hamas willing to do that? There's some discussion now about having a two-month ceasefire in return for a staged release of all the hostages.
They rejected that, I think.
Well, no, it's still on the table, apparently. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Okay, on the table, but I'm not sure that it actually is a table. I don't know why Hamas would release all the hostages. Keep in mind, they've got to retain some hostages. They're going to be dead. Again, it's filling up the tunnels with gas and throwing in a match.
Right, that's all they need to say, man.
And, yeah, and Hamas wants one of two things. Either wants victory or wants death. Wants martyrdom. Hamas, I had an interview in the Wall Street Journal several months ago where I threw out an idea that we would revisit what Israel did with the PLO in Beirut in 1982. And we told them all to get on a boat. Yasser Arafat got on a boat. I was there. I saw this. And they got on a boat and they go off. They went off to Tunis. And they maybe we should make the same offer to Hamas. You guys get on a boat. You go to Syria. You go to Libya. I could think of some tough towns in New Jersey I'd like to send you to. And some of my neighbors would know how to deal with them. And we got all the hostages back. And I threw this out. This was must in October. And now it's actually come back. The reports that the Israeli government is discussing such a deal, which is, I don't know, again, comes under the rubric of prophecy. But at the end of the day, I don't think Hamas is going to agree to it. Hamas without Gaza is nothing. They'd rather die as martyrs in Gaza, because that means that the idea of Hamas remains planted in Gaza. If they run away, that idea dies. And the idea is worth more to Hamas than their lives.
Yeah, I agree. Just given the ground invasion, I'm a little curious, what would you say to people who don't think Israel's response is proportional?
They're right.
Oh, Israel.
They're right. The people who say that Israel's response is disproportionate, they're right. It is disproportional.
I agree, and it should be. You know, if there's an existential threat on your border, you need to do whatever.
We're actually doing much, much less than we have to do. And people are shocked to hear that the atmosphere in Israel is not that we have caused too much damage to the Palestinian civilians, is that we have not done enough to defend our soldiers in order to limit the damage to Palestinian civilians. And we're seeing now groups of soldiers who are coming out of Gaza and protesting that the state is jeopardizing their lives in order to save Palestinian lives. And, you know, a small example would be the 21 soldiers who were killed last week demolishing a building. You could have demolished that building with a 2,000-pound bomb, but you don't know how many pounds of Palestinians would have done. So you've been taking tremendous risks. You know, a proportional response would be a response such as the United States did to Tokyo in 1945, or Dresden in 1945, there's a proportional response. Or do people who want a proportional response want us to choose 1,200 Palestinian civilians and behead them and burn them and rape them? That would be proportional. Right. We could also take 240 Palestinian hostages. That'd be proportional, and stick them in tunnels for 3.5 months. That'd be proportional. In international law, though, proportionality is a function of the threat. You use the force you need to stop a threat.
Of course. And Hamas is
proof. If there's still rockets falling on Tel Aviv, we have not used proportional strength.
And when you're saying this, it definitely does make sense. But what do you say? I mean, you see the images coming out of Gaza. But on a human level, when I see, you know, there's 26,000 civilians dead, you see pictures of you know, people being pulled from the rubble. It is gut-wrenching.
It is definitely gut-wrenching. And no one should celebrate this on the Israeli side.
Of course, of course.
And every Palestinian casualty is a tragedy. It is. But again, let's see it in historical perspective. Members of the administration, including the president, have accused us of bombing indiscriminately, of killing too many Palestinians, which I find a very strange locution because it begs the question, how many Palestinians killed would have been enough? What is too many? But let's look at the facts. Let's assume, for argument's sake, and it's a big argument's sake, that the Hamas figures of casualties are accurate, even though we know that Hamas inflates every single figure, every. Okay, but let's just say 25,000 killed civilians. Israel has killed 10,000 terrorists. Upwards of 30% of all the Palestinian casualties are caused by Palestinian rockets falling short. That's what happened at the Al-Ahli hospital.
Right, which a lot of misinformation surrounding that, but it's a whole other story.
Right. So if you deduct the 10,000 and duck another several thousand from Palestinian friendly fire, okay, you're going to come something close to a 2-to-1 ratio. That is two civilians killed for every combatant killed. In America's war in Afghanistan and Iraq, it was 4-to-1. In NATO's intervention in the Balkans in 1999, it was 4-to-1. It sounds cruel, it sounds cold, but it's just that Israel has achieved in Gaza something of a world record in modern warfare at a tremendous cost to ourselves. So that is not the narrative out there, but it's a patently false narrative. The best one I've heard this week is now the New York Times and other major news outlets are reporting the Hamas claim that 25,000 have been killed, including 10,000 children. Well, think. That means if we've killed 10,000 terrorists, almost all the civilians killed have been children. How does that happen? Exactly how does that happen?
I think we got to take the Gaza health ministries were owned by Hamas. So I think we really need to take what they report with a grain of salt.
I think you need a dump truck. I've been in the army for many, many years and dealing with Hamas. Yeah, here's my favorite story. Back in 2008-09, in Operation Cast Lead, I was still in the reserve as an officer. One night, 2 o'clock in the morning, we were woken up and said that two Israeli mortar shells had struck an UNRWA school and killed 21 children. Within an hour, that number had more than doubled to 51 children. And the French reported it as a fact. Then it went to the AP. And before you know it, the American press is saying Israel's killed 51 children in Gaza. It took several weeks to investigate. This is the problem, okay? When it was revealed, the truth was the mortar shells never fell within the UNRWA school. 12 people were killed. 9 of them were members of a Hamas mortar team. There were 3 civilians killed. No children were killed. But it was done. the world believed we had killed 51 kids in a UN school. And they'll do this again and again and again. So when I say, you know, 25,000 Palestinians killed, that is almost has to be a grossly inflated number. But, okay, but even given that argument, we're still at something of a world record in terms of reducing the number of civilian casualties in a warfare in which no army has faced this. You know, Gaza is significantly bigger than Mosul. Mosul had nothing like the tunnel structures that Hamas has built under Gaza. We're talking about 450 miles of tunnels that go back down hundreds of feet with elevators. Nothing like it in Iraq. And by the way, it took the U.S. Army military 9 months to win the Battle of Mosul. It took them 9 months. Those who think we're going too slow.
How long do you anticipate this war in Gaza to continue on for?
Well, I hope we'll be able to continue it for many more months.
Until, obviously, the threat's destroyed.
Now, my threat is that, you know, that somewhere in the United States will start demanding a ceasefire, or the United States will begin cutting off ammunition. In any case, the Israeli people, we are committed to seeing this through. And as I've said repeatedly, and I'll say it again, if we have to, we'll throw rocks at them.
I think that was an incredibly succinct explanation on how Israel goes to great lengths to sort of mitigate civilian casualties. I think you did a really good job there. I think you probably should have defended Israel at the ICJ. But
there's a question whether we should have gone to the ICJ at all. Alan Dershowitz, emeritus professor at Harvard, said that it was a mistake to even submit to the ICJ. Why do we bother? We did, but and the ICJ founded that, you know, we didn't, that didn't call for ceasefire, but we have to report to the ICJ on method, on ways we are reducing the threat of genocide. Okay, every month we're supposed to report. So I was on the BBC yesterday, and they asked me, how is Israel going to report to the ICJ every week? What difference is it going to make in Israel's tactics on the ground? And I said, absolutely none, zero. And they were kind of shocked. The BBC was shocked. I mean, you're just going to ignore the ICJ? I said, yeah, we're just going to ignore the ICJ because we are in a war of national survival, and we're going to do whatever we need to do in order to secure our population and to survive as a Jewish state. And they were just completely aghast that we would. And it's important to point out the ICJ is not a real court.
Right.
It is the judges are appointed by governments, and you're sitting before a tribunal of hostile governments. So the outcome is pretty much a given. I was surprised that they didn't call for a ceasefire.